This podcast contains explicit content and is not suitable for all ages. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome back to Always the Last to Know. I'm Ash.
I'm Katie.
How's everybody doing this week?
Hopefully good.
How are you?
I'm okay.
What have you been up to?
Well, it's Wednesday, beginning of April, just to sort of triangulate in time. How we
Where
record.
We are.
Yeah. Also, just so I want people to know, we are ahead. Mm-hmm. Like, we should get some acknowledgement for that. That's really big
like,
for
we're
us.
We're really putting a lot of effort into this and putting a lot of time into it. And I'm sorry, but as two neurodivergent people, we deserve to pat
to
ourselves on the
anything.
Back and get a round of applause for the amount of effort and how on task we are staying.
Yes.
Thank you.
Ashley, I'm
proud of
you.
You, Katie.
Thank you so much.
You got a new mic.
I got a new mic. Are we recording visuals for
this?
I don't
know. I'm not, but I can always. Can I take a picture on Zoom?
Please do. Actually, I need to not hold it up like that because then it looks weirdly sexual.
I don't know if I can take a picture, but I'm going to take a picture of you right now with my phone. So, momentous. Occasion.
This is a momentous occasion. Shout out to anyone who follows me on TikTok. I purchased this mic with my funds from the Creator Fund.
With your TikTok,
on TikTok
money.
So thank
I'm gonna
you
hide
all.
My face.
With my TikTok
Smile.
Cash. Thank you all so much. No, I can't have my mouth open.
No, it's a great photo though. Smile, bitch. Okay.
You should keep all of that.
Oh, I absolutely will.
Okay. So yeah, thank you to anyone who is from my TikTok who is listening to this. Shout out to y'all. Thank you so much. I got this fancy new mic. Hopefully it sounds a lot better. I think it does already, just based on what I'm hearing. So that's cool.
I think it sounds great in my ears. So yes. I'm sure it'll be even better when I go to edit this.
Yes, thank you so much for editing.
Of course. Listen, it's been a wild adventure. Mm. It really does take me about a full week to edit an episode. Along, you know, I got a lot of other shit going on. So, but I don't mind it. I kind of like it. It's pretty satisfying once you finish it.
It really is. It's really, really satisfying.
Yeah. Ask Dan when I finished the last one. And it was like all compressing together. I threw my hands up in the air and I was like, yes, finally, it is complete.
I definitely remember a few like throwing my headphones off like, yeah, done.
Oh, yeah.
When
also,
I was
throwing your
editing.
Headphones off when you get frustrated at it, too.
Oh, yeah. Especially when I was trying to edit on my old computer, which is actually like currently off to the side of me right now and facing me, so like as I talk shit about it, it's just like looking at me,
it's just staring,
just
into your soul.
staring at me on this laptop like, what the fuck is wrong with you? I got the color wheel of death a lot of times on that a lot of times. But yeah, we were talking before this and we were like, you know what, let's include this in our episode for a hot second. We were talking about TikTok.
Oh,
and
TikTok.
Their algorithm.
Which is just so confusing. And if you're on TikTok, you know that it is way harder than any other social media algorithm to figure out.
I don't understand it at all.
And there are actual software engineers on Instagram who have like tried to reverse engineer it. And
yes.
We
Ooh, what was her username again?
Yes. Oh my god, this one woman.
This just
okay.
Gorgeously brilliant person made this
yes.
Video.
And I feel like we both saw her video within like days of each other.
We must have, because our For You pages are so terrifyingly,
so,
disgustingly similar.
So very similar.
It's out of control.
We'll send each other videos, and then we'll be like, yeah, I saw that one already.
Yep, saw that one.
Felicia for the win. At yes. Felicia for the win. She is a 30-year-old software engineer, and
brilliant.
She has been trying to figure out the TikTok algorithm for a while now, and she just posted a video talking about how she thinks that she has finally figured it out. And it was so interesting to watch.
It was the one about the ratios, right?
A lot of timing. You know what? Honestly, though, I still feel like it's a lot of luck.
Mm-hmm.
Like, timing is everything, and trying to make sure that you have a perfect ratio between your views to the likes, to the comments.
Yes,
so,
totally.
I can't, we'll fact check later, but I can't remember exactly what it was. But I feel like the example was, if you have 100 views, you need to have at least, what was it, 20 likes?
I think it was 10. And then
10, was it 10 likes? Because I thought it was 10 comments.
But I think it was 1,000
views. Oh, 1,000 views?
10 likes, and then like one comment.
Okay. See?
That's what I thought it was.
We'll fact check.
Yes.
I'll put in a little blurb at the end, but it was very interesting. And then we were also talking about the fact that, like, Katie has, like, an insane amount of followers, but I've been on TikTok longer, and I was posting very consistent content and everything. I had one video that hit 10K, and then nothing else has happened. Like, I only usually hit, like, 200 to 300, maybe sometimes, like, 600. And, you know, I put a lot of time and effort into this stuff. Not that I'm, like, upset about it. This is just observation, where I also saw someone who had kind of like a theory about the fact that if your first couple of posts don't blow up right away, your page never will, which I think is very interesting. It's almost like being punished because you didn't do so great.
I don't know about that, because I posted like at least 15 to 20 videos, which just did nothing before I posted the time travel one.
Okay. That also, but when you posted that one, it was a stitch from another popular one, right?
It was, yeah.
That might have helped.
Oh, I'm sure it did.
It would have been interesting to see if, like, one of the ones that you posted organically without a stitch, if that one had blown up first after 10 or 15 that didn't. That would have been interesting to see.
Yeah, that would be interesting.
Anyway, my whole job is social media, so this stuff is fascinating to me. But it just, like, TikTok is the one that just consistently confuses me.
Yeah, me too. And I'm like actively trying to, you know, make money through the creator fund. Obviously not like support myself by any means, but just, you know, like make some extra cash to throw into this business and stuff like that, which I did with this microphone.
Which you did. Like, it looks really thing. It looks really cool at the angle you have it at right now.
It feels really professional. When we're together, there's actually a setting that it has for people sitting across from each other.
Oh my god.
Yeah, it felt I did some investigating before I
birthday
purchased this
episode.
What up? It's my birthday, everyone. Katie's it's in like birth- a month.
Yeah, Katie's April birthday 30th. Is on the 30th.
Yes.
It's in my calendar.
It should be in everyone's calendar.
Oh my god. Really quick on the TikTok thing, go follow Felicia for the win.
Yeah.
Because she's got a bunch of other great videos, but that is honestly super fascinating from a software engineer's standpoint of trying to reverse engineer an algorithm.
Yes. And while you're on TikTok, you should follow the podcast's TikTok and also us on TikTok if you're not. Just like while you're there.
Just, you know, make us happy.
Yeah. It
make us feel better.
It'd be really nice. It'd be cool. So TikTok is actually a really solid segue into our episode's topic. So I think it's time to get into it.
Fact check time. The ratio was 1,000 views to 100 likes to 2 comments.
Okay. I guess I should explain how TikTok comes into this. We're talking about fast fashion.
Yes.
And in typical Katie format, this started out as one thing and then went into a deep dive as another thing. And then it was like way too much history. But you know what? I'm not apologizing.
I love it when you go in depth, dude. I love it. I'm here for it.
Definitely less pages of notes than the Havana Syndrome, but also a smaller font.
Oh,
so I don't know what that means.
All right.
TikTok and how that comes into fast fashion is simply just advertising. And I'll get into all of that a little bit later. But originally, what I wanted to talk about was the clothing industry, fast fashion, and size inclusivity. And before I could get into talking about that, I needed to look into the history of the fashion industry and how fast fashion came into being. It's super fucking dark.
I'm ready for these knowledge bombs.
It's super fucking dark. And it leads to a pretty dark present, highlighting what looks to be like a pretty fucking dark future.
One of the things that really strikes me about fast fashion is the absolutely horrible implications that it has on our environment.
Oh my God.
And I know that that's not necessarily the angle that you're going to be discussing it in today, but that is something that has always struck me.
That does come up.
Companies that do that kind of stuff. And when we say fast fashion, like, I'll give you two brands so that everybody just kind of knows what we're talking about. But like Fashion Nova and Shein, or Sheen, however you want to say it.
Yep. Yep. Those two. And I get into a couple other brands a little bit later, and the environmental aspects.
Okay. I also just want to like preface this by saying that we're going to highlight this while also understanding the nuance of the fact that there is no ethical consumption under capitalism.
Oh, totally. That's literally like my first paragraph.
Just want to like put that out there to begin with. So yes. Nobody gets mad at us.
Yes. So I
don't want to shame anyone for buying something that's $2 if that's all they can afford, you know? No.
And I have a disclaimer, which does go into that. Okay, so cool. It starts off with, I need to say here that a lot of people cannot afford anything besides fast fashion. And that is part of the issue of this entire cycle. No one should feel guilty for that, because like Ash and I, we have to purchase clothes that have unethical backgrounds. We can't, you know, we're all trying to make step towards supporting more ethical shops, but it's not always an easy, quick switch. And everyone...
Or an affordable one.
And we're all trapped in a cycle that the system wants us to be in. And we're here to call out the system and the cycle, not the people trapped in it.
Yes.
So do not be like, oh my God, like I buy from those brands. I also do as well. And as much as
it's all I can afford right now.
It's all I can afford. So please like keep that in mind throughout this whole episode. And I bring it up again later. Okay.
Just want to cover our bases real quick.
So we're going to go back to a point where everything obviously was done by hand. And I would be so incredibly fucked in this time period. I have no skills. I'd be so screwed. I like clothes are made for me and I purchase them and I can barely dress myself now. This would just be, oh my God. Materials were washed and prepped by hand, woven into fabrics and then put into clothing. And like considering the time that we're talking about in the US, the 1800s, we all know that a lot of the work of gathering the materials was done by the enslaved people in the South. When it came to the actual making of clothing, we're looking at a huge, large gap in pay based on professions. So we have what's known as like dressmakers and seamstresses. Seamstresses worked from home, taking pre-cut fabric to make clothes for enslaved people, minors, and what was referred to in a few sources as New England gentlemen.
What?
That's all I got.
Okay. It just sounds so...
What a third option in that list.
Yeah. It sounds pompous compared to the rest.
Oh, it totally is. It's just enslaved people, miners, and New England gentlemen. Like, what the fuck? Okay, anyway.
Anyway.
Being a seamstress at the time was one of the only socially acceptable jobs for women. And women of all ages. For immigrants, children, widows, etc. Dressmakers were the people who selected fabrics, designed exclusive, custom, and like extravagant outfits for people who could afford that kind of money.
Okay.
There weren't like a lot of clothing shops at that time. Tailor shops, and then a quote from the National Museum on America's History of Sweatshops, an exception from stuff just being custom made by tailors or at home, was the so-called slop shop, which produced and sold cheap, ready-made garments for unmarried laborers, sailors on long voyages, and increasingly after the 1810s for enslaved people. So that's another way that seamstresses were provided jobs. As fashion changed, things like looser clothes kind of became in style. So outfits didn't need to be like perfectly tailored to a person's body. So ready-to-wear clothing became more acceptable socially.
What? An interesting phrase for it. Ready to wear.
Yeah, and that's what it is referred to out like throughout the entire episode, is ready to wear clothing before it becomes fast fashion, basically.
Yeah.
So with this kind of opening for new money making, this allowed tailor shops and slop shops to spend downtime producing ready to wear clothing. So yeah, like good little capitalists, these owners of tailor shops were like, not a lot of people are... customizing clothes right now. Must do something with my workers. And started making ready-to-wear clothing. From the same museum that I talked about earlier, quote, as demand for ready-made clothing increased in the 1820s, shop owners found they could reduce their labor costs by cutting the cloth themselves, farming out the simple sewing tasks to women working at home and paying them 25 to 50% less than the male journeyman tailors. This
Of course.
This innovation led to the rise of garment industry sweatshops.
Yo, I'm sorry. The way that they called that an innovation.
Innovation. Yes.
Let's screw over the women. It's an innovation.
You know what? These women need money, and we can pay them so much less because where else are they going to go? Innovative. Like, are you shitting? And that's why I wanted to, like, quote, because there's a lot of, like, really frustrating language that comes into play with how we talk about history. For the record, a lot of times they were referred to as slaves, not enslaved people. Just gotta throw that out there.
Yeah.
And then also when we talk about how to fix this problem, and I do have a little paragraph on that, naturally. So that's the 1820s. We're gonna fast forward a decade. The sewing machine is invented. And once the sewing process is sped up, everything else is. So around this time, in order to save money and time, which in a capitalistic world is money, tailors started taking on proportional drafting and sizing systems. So this is where we start seeing small, medium, large. And while they're not called that, we're starting to standardize the sizes of our clothing to save money.
Okay.
And then this is a pretty big jump, but just bear with me. In 1864, with the Civil War requiring massive amounts of uniforms for soldiers, the ready-to-wear industry boomed. Lots of uniforms were required. Lots of money being funded into this. So the garment manufacturers built factories and networks of seamstresses in order to meet these demands. It's important to note that, like, the seamstresses who worked from home were, like, totally isolated, not really able to talk to anyone else. It kind of separates your ability of, like, community and, like, collective bargaining, which obviously wouldn't have really been a possibility due to sexism. But it's just important to know, like, the isolation that these seamstresses at home were dealing with. And then on top of the sweatshops of people just being jammed into factories with sewing machines and machinery to produce clothing. It's just horrible. And a lot of these were women working for these manufacturers were immigrants from other countries, wives, children, widows of impoverished farmers, people who, like, genuinely didn't have any other choices available to them.
Yeah.
As time continued to pass, it became not just women, but also men. Eastern Europeans migrated over to America and introduced the task system. Men and women worked as teams of sewing machine operators, basters, and finishers, often augmented by pressers and helpers. Payment was for completion of a certain number of garments per day. So that's the task system.
Oh my gosh.
You get paid by, like, how many you make.
Okay, okay.
Which it's still just as bad, because if the manufacturers found problems or didn't like it, etc., they would still keep the work, but you would not get paid for it.
Yeah. That sounds a lot like exploitation.
It really was.
Oh, capitalism.
It was not uncommon for a team to work 15 to 18 hours a day for 6 days, but only be paid for 4 days of work.
Can we just say, thank God for the workers' rights that we do have now.
Truly.
They can be better, but thank God for the ones that we do have now.
Truly. And I have, like, a little bit of a timeline and when those workers' rights come in and things like that, but also a little bit of a timeline about how didn't really do much for everyone or even for the U.S. And I do want to note that while this was talking about kind of the late 1800s, a source said that it wasn't until after World War I that previously enslaved people started migrating north and ended up in this industry. But I don't think that that's, like, a hard line, that it's like not before. It's a lot of people. So the country started seeing apartments doubling as tenement shops with just
absolutely horrible living and working conditions.
Oh my god.
The tenement sweatshops doubled as living quarters and contract shops. So they would illegally house 8 to 9 families at a time in a space designated for one.
You know, I feel like in high school, we were definitely shown some photos of those kinds of, like, especially in, like, New York City mm-hmm. and stuff like that, of, you know, 5 families squeezed into one tiny place. That's yeah. absolutely insane.
Where they both lived and worked. So they never got to escape said tiny place. It's all the time.
That's insane.
Yeah, it was just awful. And then, you know, between the 1870s and 1900s, the fashion and clothing industry almost like fully secures itself as a base of the economy, really solidifying its space in our world.
Because everybody needs clothes.
Because everyone needs clothes. And it's been long enough now that not everyone is being taught how to make their own clothes. So now, you know, we're about this started, you know, in the beginning of the 1800s, we're about 100 years away from that. Not everyone is making their own clothes or even knows how to. Yeah. We've kind of dropped that skill a little bit. As the need and wants for more ready-to-wear fashion increased, so did the need to make it faster and more standardized. If you know exactly what you're making, exactly what size you're going to make, you can just bust those out rather than doing a little bit of this size and making things really custom. So they started moving away from tenement sweatshops to small, cramped factories in high-rise lofts. Well, oh, sorry, what were you going
to
say?
Just thinking to myself, they'll really put it anywhere.
Oh, literally fucking anywhere. Conditions in these factories were largely considered an improvement from the tenement sweatshops.
I almost just spit out my wine.
Yes.
Sure. I'm sure they were much better.
Yeah, because at least they get to, like, leave and they're not constantly surrounded by, you know, their work and things like that, but they are still in cramped, overcrowded, dirty, like musty factories with hundreds of workers hunched over long rows of sewing machines for like barely any pay. The workforce grew from about 120,000 to 206,000. And then, you know, we start seeing things like the first Sears catalog in 1897. You know, a mail in to order. Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry. Say the date of the first Sears catalog.
1897.
I don't think I've ever known how old Sears is, but I didn't think it was that old.
Isn't that fucking crazy? And I have like a picture of one of the ads and it like tells you how to measure yourself so you can like order your fucking clothes, basically.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll definitely post that.
Oh yeah, it's really, really interesting. And as you said before, we saw photos from New York City. New York City was producing 40% of the ready-to-wear clothing.
Wow.
As the workforce grew, the treatment truly got worse. And just like money, money, money was the entire focus.
Ah, yes. Greed and capitalism, hand in hand.
The entire basis for, honestly, the fashion industry.
A lot of things.
And as you were saying, we didn't have a lot of workers' rights. None of these laws had really been passed whatsoever.
At this point, we probably still didn't have child labor laws.
No, not really.
I just saw a photo of like a 3-year-old chimney sweep because I follow this like history photographed page.
Jesus.
Covered in soot. And then there were people in the comments being like, what a great work ethic. I'm like, are you?
The fuck?
Are you actually insane? Are you actually, that is a 3-year-old. Or they'd be like, oh, when all these people want to complain about their jobs, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, a 3-year-old should not be a chimney sweep. What fucking planet are you on?
How is that the answer to anything? Is 3-year-old olds getting jobs? Also, have they met a fucking 3-year-old? You're gonna put a 3-year-old in your fucking chimney? That's the stupidest thing I've ever fucking heard.
I'm gonna send you the post on Instagram when we're done.
Absolutely please do.
Because I went into the comment section and I really thought that it was gonna be a lot of people being like, oh my god, this is horrific. And while there were those people, I was extremely shocked at the amount of people who were trying to be assholes with that
just horrible. Just fucking horrible.
Okay, continue. Yeah. Yeah, child labor laws.
Child labor laws. Workers' rights. So important. The conditions of these factories were absolutely deadly. So there was an incident that gets referenced a lot, and there was, I think, a My Favorite Murder episode about this.
I know. Know which one?
March 25th, 1911, a fire broke out in the Triangle Shirtwaist Company on the 8th floor of the Osh building in the heart of New York City's garment district. It began in the cutting room and quickly spread throughout the factory. Locked doors and inadequate fire exits trapped the workers inside, and the building's sole fire escape collapsed. In all, 146 employees died, most of them young Jewish and Italian immigrant women who, trigger warning for suicide, either jumped to their deaths or perished in the flames. The fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company factory became a national symbol of business neglect and abuse. And that is a quote from the National Museum on Americans History, which I use a lot as a source. Big shout out to that museum. As that happened, eyes are now on the industry. And yet, the next bullet I have is, seeking the option to lower costs even more, companies started looking outside of New York in order to avoid higher rent fees, outside of New York City.
Okay.
So in the 1920s, Chicago, Illinois, and Rochester, New York became the centers of the men's clothing industry. Philadelphia, Baltimore, Boston, San Francisco, and Cincinnati were also busy production sites. In the 1930s, LA has like a booming sportswear industry, but all of these...
That's interesting.
Right? All of these relied on like modern factories, contract shops, home workers, and sweatshops. After the fire in New York City, and as these businesses start spreading out across the country, more people are experiencing and talking about these horrible working conditions.
Just human nature.
Human nature. So after decades of all of this, social reformers and labor rights activists were like, if we can start applying the right pressure to the right spots, we can end sweatshops in the U.S. garment industry, specifically the U.S. They are still very much so happening all around the world.
Yeah, they are.
Yeah. Unions began forming. And from the 1900s into the 1930s, with labor strikes, community organizing, investigations, and local and state legislation, the groundwork for the federal New Deal reforms in the 1930s were laid down. And those were designed to eliminate sweatshops and strengthen unions in like more industries than where they were existing.
Oh, that's great.
President Franklin D. Roosevelt is the one who brought the New Deal legislation forward, which granted unions legal protection to organize. And with that, membership in the needle trade unions rose to more than 400,000.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And that was like out of 600,000.
Incredible.
So, incredible. Right? Yeah, so they really started.
It's amazing what people will do when they're tired of the bullshit.
Absolutely. Through newly won union gains backed up by this government support, the worst of the sweatshop conditions began to disappear. Then in 1938, the Fair Labor Standards Act introduces a minimum federal wage and a maximum amount of hours of like 44 hours a week, which then 3 years later would be shortened down to 40. So then like anything after that's considered like overtime.
Okay.
All of these regulations and stricter unions kept legal sweatshops out of the U.S. But the constant demand for lower prices to like kind of keep customers coming back meant that companies were still constantly looking for lower cost manufacturing. They started outsourcing abroad for non-union workers. So despite increases in the U.S. clothing consumption, it dropped 37% in workers in 1995. It went from one...
When?
1995. Oh. Okay, let me... So in 1970, it was 1.2 million.
Okay.
Total. And then in 1995, it was less than a million.
Okay.
It was like 7,600. Okay. And while we will get back to international sweatshops, I do want to note that it's not like sweatshops just immediately disappeared from the U.S. entirely after that. That's like not even close. Not even close.
Of course they didn't. Why would we expect anything else?
No, we shouldn't expect anything else. In 1995, 72 Thai garment workers were found working as what was referred to as modern-day slaves in a hidden sweatshop in suburban LA. Oh. These workers were recruited from impoverished Thai rural villages with the promise of a better future in America, only to be held captive and forced to sew clothing for up to 17 to 22 hours a day.
Oh my God. Really quick, when you said that they were promised a better life, I was thinking earlier about the fact that when you were telling me that all of these people are shoved in together and working in grueling conditions, it's amazing to me that people immigrated here for a better life in America, for the American dream, and like that's what they're getting.
Yeah, yeah.
A large majority of people coming here. And that's just really sad that that's what they're getting after coming to a place that they thought was going to treat them better. I'm sure on some level it was a bit better, but still, you're still getting the shit end of the stick.
Yeah, it's human trafficking. You know, you're promised something else and then they're held captive. And that is from the matterprints.com journal history of sweatshops. And I'll include that in my sources. There's a little bit more to that, but like, yeah, it's fucking horrible. You're promised these things and it's not even close to what you're given. And I'm sure people are like, well, that was the 90s. Sweatshops are still an issue as recently as of 2021, and I'm sure absolutely right now. In 2021, September 14th, CBS spoke to a few garment workers in Los Angeles who described their working conditions as, quote, modern day slavery, and said they paid us like 5 and 6 cents for a piece.
What?
Yeah. The article cited a 2016 U.S. Department of Labor investigation, which found pay violations in 85% of L.A. garment shops that it looked into.
I know people can't see this, but my mouth is just like wide open. 85. That is insane.
And almost all of those factories that were looked into produce garments for fast fashion. Trendy items commonly promoted on social media like TikTok. They spoke to a worker who had spent nearly 30 years sewing in garment factories in Guatemala, Mexico, and the US. He talked about the hot conditions, visible cockroaches, and the horrible per piece pay, which led to pay as low as $2.68 an hour.
Wow. And why? How? How, if we have labor laws? How?
The hiring of immigrants who aren't a protected group of people. And because they are often not taken seriously or listened to by other people, their, you know, working conditions and problems are often not taken seriously. Super fucked up.
They're still humans. Like, mm-hmm. There's just a level of respect that we should all be treating each other with that is so lost in humanity nowadays. And it's really disappointing.
Absolutely. And it's about to get worse.
Oh, because of course it is.
Of course it is. So like I said before, companies started and are now outsourcing their garment manufacturing to sweatshops in various Asian countries, including but not limited to China, Vietnam, Cambodia, Bangladesh. I also found a few sources talking about some sweatshops in India, and I'll cite some of those studies. So I want to get into the conditions of those places for a little bit.
Whew.
It's so bad.
It's so bad.
It's so bad. Just like trigger warning, child abuse.
Because of course.
Sexual harassment, just like the mention of it. I don't go deep into it, but like it's mentioned. So there's a nonprofit organization called the Borgen Project, and they address poverty and hunger. So I was looking at one of their, like I was kind of looking at their breakdowns on specific countries and their issues. So one of them was talking about Bangladesh, and Bangladesh's economy is mostly dependent on the textile and garment industry. Garments account for around 80% of the country's exports, and around 3.5 million workers in Bangladesh, 85% of which are women, work long hours with pay too low to support themselves and their families. Not only is the pay low, but they also work in cramped, dangerous conditions without any financial protection. Majority female workers are also subject to sexual harassment and other forms of sexism in the workplace. Another nonprofit, waronwant.org, said that many are forced to work 14 to 16 hours a day, 7 days a week, with some workers finishing at 3 a.m. only to start again the same morning at 7:30 a.m.
Oh my God, I knew you were going to say like 6 or 7.
Yes.
It's the clopin from hell.
Yeah. The International Labor Organization estimates that 170 million workers around the world are engaged in child labor, many of them making textiles and garments to satisfy the demands of consumers in Europe, the US, and beyond. Right now, I want to reiterate, I am not talking about any of this to make consumers feel bad. I'm going to get into how much money a lot of these companies make. It's absurd.
Sickening compared to what people are being paid for the work that goes into this.
Absolutely.
While the ones who make the most get to sit pretty in their offices.
Absolutely. So this next quote is taken directly from a study on the occupational health of factories in India, where a majority of the workers were teen girls, a lot of them under the age of 17.
Okay.
One of the main health risks is exposure to cotton dust, which is released into the atmosphere as a result of the processing of cotton fibers into fabrics. Breathing in cotton dust may cause several adverse health impacts. Short-term exposure can lead to chest tightness, coughing, wheezing, weakness, fever, chills, breathing problems. Long-term exposure can cause permanent and disabling breathing difficulties, including bronchitis with emphysema.
I'm assuming they probably don't give them masks to wear.
Well, that's my next quote.
Oh, okay.
While workers are provided with protective gear due to like the temperatures, humidity, and, you know, all of the machinery processing, creating heat in there, it's often too uncomfortable to wear the protective gear.
I'm sure they're sweating their fucking asses off. I am sure.
A worker in Super Spinning Mills, who wanted to keep her identity a secret, was quoted saying, "Workers will get protective gears from the factory only once. They will scold us if we ask for another."
You're not supposed to continue using the same masks.
No, you're not.
It renders them ineffective.
Yeah.
And they're sweating into it.
Yeah. And they're getting... So I don't have this quoted directly here, but I was like, in that same study about the young women in India, they were talking about what they're paid versus like the cost of living. And it was like they're paid monthly 2,000 taka when the cost of living minimum is 5,000.
Exploitation.
Yeah.
To the fullest.
And that, I didn't look this up in US, but I think they said they're paid roughly monthly 25 euros when they require about 45 euros. Don't know what that is, US dollars. The factories, okay. Oh my God, I forgot for a second. That just gets darker. Okay. Moving over to factories in China. The factories that employ Chinese workers are incredibly dangerous. They live in crowded dormitories, so like similar to the tenement sweatshops that we were talking about way back when. Those are still happening now in China. And because they live there and have no access to childcare, there's like a high risk of exposure to harmful molecules like silica dust and lead, which comes from that Borgen, the nonprofit from their magazine.
Okay.
So like they're just like breathing in just like horrible fucking shit all the time.
Wow.
And... fast fashion in China is like directly interconnected with human trafficking, specifically forced labor trafficking. So a lot of times when we hear human trafficking, we think of like forced sex work. But actually a huge, huge issue is forced labor trafficking. And this is a huge part of the global trend in the fashion industry. So
I'm going to be honest, I was not aware of that. And I'm even more horrified.
Yeah. So
even more horrified.
Something that I learned about in my research that exists is something called the Global Slavery Index, which is like the organization that tracks slaves in the world being used right now. Like I said, we hear a lot about sex trafficking, but very often what's not discussed, and this is part of why I made this whole episode about this instead of what I wanted to talk about, which in like the light of all of this feels a little bit silly, which was how as a plus size person, I often am forced to buy fast fashion because there are no other options, which I do get into a little bit. But when I'm looking at websites and things called the Global Slavery Index, that sort of becomes the whole fucking topic.
It's a little bit more important than our feelings on what fits our body
enough. Than just this. And it's incredibly important for us to understand the whole cycle that we are trapped in. Because at first I just wanted to talk about, like, I can't afford a lot of stuff, so I have to buy fast fashion and it sucks because environment. And then I dove into Global fucking Slavery Index and was like, holy shit, this is a bigger cycle than what gets talked about. And we need to talk about it. So in 2018, the Global Slavery Index determined that fast fashion, textiles, garment industry were one of the top five imported goods at risk for being produced by trafficked laborers. Number two, actually.
I don't really have words for that.
Yeah. Just wanted...
Just a lot of disappointment.
Yeah. So The Guardian is where I got that information from, and I'll cite this source, but they stated that one of the biggest challenges in tackling child labor in the fashion supply is the complex supply chain for each garment. Even when brands have strict guidelines in place for suppliers, work often gets subcontracted to other factories that the buyer may not even know about. Which feels like a really interesting way for companies to be like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Plausible deniability. Because The Guardian goes into, like, the other things that companies can do to start combating child labor, which is, like, register all of your suppliers. Sometimes companies have hundreds of suppliers and, you know, have a registry of where all of those are coming from. And go and investigate these suppliers. Look for signs of subcontracting. Like, if you go to a factory and you're like, this factory is so small, there's no way they could be producing my 5,000 order. Where is that coming from? Just like, I don't know, some fucking follow through is all The Guardian made it seem like we needed, honestly.
Yeah.
Which was frustrating. I think they tried to make it seem like it would take a lot. But as a person just reading, I was like, okay, I just sort of assumed they're doing these things already. Apparently they're not.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? That's insane.
Just a little bit of follow through, please.
Well, the people involved in producing the items of fast fashion are abused in every way possible. Let's talk about some of the environmental issues of fast fashion, because it wasn't bad enough that we are harming people. Fast fashion is absolutely destroying our fucking planet. According to Business Insider, fashion production companies comprise 10% of total global carbon emissions. So, like, as much as the entire European Union.
Wow.
Yeah. It dries up water sources and pollutes rivers and streams, while 85% of all textiles go to dumps each year.
Especially because the fast fashion stuff is so poorly made. It just falls apart.
It just falls apart. Or fashion trends change so fucking quickly that no one is buying it anymore. So rather than donating it, they just fucking dump it. Like, horrible people. And then a lot of the fabrics that are used to make this are, like, not awesome. So even washing clothes releases 500,000 tons of microfibers into the ocean each year. The equivalent of 50 billion plastic bottles.
Great. Great. That's just...
fucking insane. Wow. So, like, well, everyone is, like, talking to people being like, recycle your water bottles. Companies need to do better.
Yeah, listen, it's not on the individual and the kind of straw that you use. It's these massive companies that do not give a fuck
not at all
about whether their product is sustainable, whether it's going to impact the environment, or whether the means of production are affecting the environment and in turn us and our bodies in the process.
The Qantas International report in 2018 found that the three main drivers of the industry's global pollution impacts are dyeing and finishing, that was 36%, yarn preparation, 28%, and fiber production, which was 15%. The report also established that the fiber production has the largest impact on freshwater withdrawal, which they had defined as water diverted or withdrawn from a surface water or groundwater source. Okay. I wanted to include that definition because I was like, what the fuck does that mean? Freshwater withdrawal. It sounds like it would be straightforward, but I didn't know. So there's the definition. The fashion industry consumes 1/10 of all of the water used industrially to run factories and clean products. Of all industrial shit, the fashion industry is 1/10 of all of the water.
Wow.
So to put this into perspective and probably make y'all want to throw up, it takes 10,000 liters of water to produce 1 kilogram of cotton, or approximately 3,000 liters of water for 1 cotton shirt.
Stop! No! No, not... Oh.
Yeah.
Oh my god, that's a ridiculous amount.
Yep.
One shirt.
And keeping in mind that a documentary released in 2015, The True Cost, found that the average American now generates 82 pounds of textile waste each year.
Wow.
I don't know how many fucking cotton shirts that is, but that's literally a lot of just water thrown away.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
No matter what we do, as far as our recycling goes on an individual level, no matter what we do, it's never going to get better if we have companies producing stuff like this.
Yeah.
We live in such a consumeristic world that the majority of us are not going to take the steps necessary to cut these things out of our lives because of how convenient it is. We really need to cut it off.
How convenient it is and how cheap it is, considering how little a lot of us get paid in this world where our federal minimum wage is like $8.
Oh.
So
it should be at like 20.
Seriously.
That's another conversation.
Synthetic materials, primary culprits that cause plastic microfibers to enter our ocean. Talked about that. The fashion industry is currently responsible for more annual carbon emissions than all international flights and maritime shipping combined.
That's absurd. Yes. Absolutely absurd.
Fucking insane. It's fucking insane. So here's something that really frustrated me a lot, and we've touched on it a little bit in our little bit of rants, but while I was finding all, you know, reading all of these stats and stuff, a lot of the conversation is about what it would cost consumers to, you know, double the pay of child laborers, or what it would cost us to buy more sustainable clothing. And I feel like we're starting to see this trend, or we're in this trend, where everyone is putting the cost on consumers of fast fashion and not the businesses making most of the profits.
I also think that it's interesting, the example that you just gave about the cost of it for us, when something that's made sustainably is honestly probably going to last longer than something that is made in the way that Fashion Nova and Shein make them. And a lot of other companies that do it in a really shitty way, like those, I've literally had sweaters fall apart the month that I got them. Yeah. If we're going to be putting in the effort to make something that lasts longer and is more sustainable, sure, it might be a little bit more expensive up front, but we won't be needing to buy as much as quickly, yep, as we do with the fast fashion. It'll offset the cost of it a little bit for the average consumer.
Yeah.
It's these fucking companies who don't want to, they don't want to lose out on, exactly, profits. So they don't want to change to something sustainable.
Exactly. It's just so frustrating that we're always seeing you must be responsible buyers and not these companies should be responsible sellers. Because when we talk about a lot of the changes that we need to buy more sustainable stuff, it's really difficult in this capitalism world where people aren't paid very much. I mean, it comes back to this cycle that we are just fucking stuck in. Shein, a popular fast fashion company, as of April 5th, 2022, is worth $100 billion.
Jesus Christ.
$100 fucking billion.
Absolutely
dollars.
Insane.
Other companies that are considered fast fashion or are known to use sweatshops, Forever 21, a little bit of both, $1.4 billion. Disney, a little bit of both, is worth $203 billion. And while it's a little bit different because they're not like a fashion industry, they're also, you know, they make clothes and they're also like, you know, making a lot of fucking money, that you think that they'd be able to stop for a second and make sure that their stupid expensive t-shirts are going to last a little bit fucking longer. Sorry, guys, I'm really frustrated about this. Nike, which had a lot of child labor and sweatshop issues back in the 90s, still considered fast fashion, still using sweatshops. H&M and Torrid.
Oh, and that's a big one too, especially for people like us who are on the bigger side. And there is such a, like, I have to shop from Shein, Curve more than Torrid, especially because we all loved Torrid for a long time, but they've been hella problematic.
Super lately. Problematic. And why are they always trying to expose my fucking shoulders?
That, and also compared to Shein. So, like, you could get something from Shein that is like $5. You can get the same thing from Torrid for like 40.
Dude, their jeans like are expensive. I can get,
you know, my cute shawls that I mm-hmm. have? I can get them from Shein for like literally $3. And at Torrid, I think the most expensive one I paid for was $60. Yeah. And it ripped almost instantly because it's not made well.
No, it's not. And when we start listing these companies, here's where we start running into issues that include the cost of living. Fast fashion is often the only thing that people can afford to purchase, which perpetuates a horrible cycle of fueling these industries, having us purchase shitty clothes that fall apart instantly, not having enough money to buy sustainable clothing, and we just keep fucking going. And as inflation raises and minimum wage doesn't, we are just stuck in this cycle of clothing produced with non-sustainable fabrics, and with profits in mind, they aren't made to last. We're constantly having to continue to spend more money resupplying our clothing that's falling apart. And then you turn into plus size fashion, which is both expensive as hell and still falls under fast fashion issues. So what prompted this whole episode, really, originally, was this incredible article in Refinery29, written by a person I proclaim as a genius, Olivia Muntier, in November of 2021. And they pose a really fucking important question. With more consumers educated on the topic, it's not uncommon for influencers and celebrities to be criticized or shamed for shopping or promoting fast fashion. And while we should all be working to minimize our carbon footprint, is the generalized message that says we all should be shopping from sustainable retailers fair if over 60% of women aren't included in the size charts of the movement? Super fucking real.
Yep.
It's a very real problem.
There are very little stores where I can find something that fits me and also is flattering to the point where I feel okay wearing it.
Something that fits me, like that fits my style, mm-hmm. that is comfortable.
Fits my body.
Yeah.
Compliments
me. It's not easy. And as is brought up, over 60% of women are often not included in what's referred to as straight sizes. In the same article, Olivia speaks with Marielle Elizabeth, a writer, photographer, and expert who's been working in the intersection of ethical and plus-size fashion for years. Love it. She says, plus-size people, regardless of whether we're talking about ethical fashion or fast fashion, have really only been able to buy pieces in their size with any level of trendiness, and even that feels tenuous as a plus-size person, in the last few years. Options for trendy clothes have really only been open to plus size people within the last maybe decade, if we're being really, really generous.
Yeah, because I'm sorry, but just slapping floral prints on it, Torrid, is not fucking trendy.
No, it's not trendy. And honestly,
please give us something else.
I remember in college when I discovered, I think it was my senior year, so this would be like 2012, 2013, when I discovered Forever 21's plus size section had like started expanding.
Didn't even know they had one.
Yes, that's, yeah. And like truly it wasn't even that inclusive. I think it went up to like maybe 3X, not that great. But it was one of those things where it's like, I think it was maybe like a page or two. You know what I mean? Like there wasn't a lot of options. And it was always like one particular style, like the Torrid florals or these like, I don't know, absurd patterns of like clashing things and just nothing, not options.
It's not
give me your just give me your options up to you know 5x 6x whatever. Why is this so fucking difficult? And hold on, there's a quote that I apparently didn't No, I know I did put it in my notes, but I apparently didn't save my notes. There is, this was just like a really interesting quote that I wanted to include. Gianluca Russo, a plus size fashion expert and author of the up and coming book, The Power of Plus, says that he has mixed feelings about tagging fast fashion brands on social media. As someone in the plus size.
Like to call them
no,
out?
No, to like when he's like wearing an outfit.
Oh, okay.
As someone in plus size fashion space, it's nerve-wracking to tag the brands I'm wearing on Instagram when I know a majority of them are fast fashion. But the truth is, that's all I have, he shares. As a plus size man, my options for clothing are abysmal.
I feel like it's definitely worse for them.
Yeah.
Especially if you're someone who is trying to be fashionable.
Absolutely.
And not just wear plain stuff.
Absolutely. And he went on to say that if we stay silent about the limited options we're finding, then we're doing a disservice to those who look to us for inspiration and guidance. You know, so it's this catch 22 almost of like, I want to help other people feel good in their clothing and feel like the boss badasses that they are. But I also don't want to perpetuate this idea that fast fashion is ethically okay, because it's not.
Yeah.
But it's also all a lot of people have for a variety of reasons. Whether it's inclusivity of sizes, whether it's money things, we're all trapped in this cycle for a variety of reasons, and we're all just fucking stuck. And I don't know what to do about it. And truly, that's the end of my notes. I don't know what to do.
I also don't know what to do about it. I mean, we have to start. I think the first thing is start actually holding these companies accountable.
Absolutely.
For the way that they are treating their workers and for the way that they are producing their products.
Absolutely.
There needs to be better checks and balances on these companies on a legislative level, I believe.
Absolutely. And obviously I knew that the conditions in which a lot of things were made were not great. I was like aware of that, but it really wasn't until reading through all of this that it was Global Slavery Index. You know, when
the fact that there's that much that we need that kind of a program or software to track that kind of stuff. It's absurd.
It's upsetting. It's frustrating. You know, as we start looking around at this cycle that we're trapped in, really frustrating to just see how horrible it is. Because a lot of when I went into doing this, I was only under the impression I would be talking about the environmental impacts of fast fashion and how I as an environmentalist feel stuck. And it turns out that I as a humanitarian want to throw up and learn how to fucking sew immediately.
There are so many things in our society that intersect with one another on such a level that I don't think that we all even realize at first until you really start to get into the nitty gritty of it.
Absolutely.
And we can care about more than one thing at once. We can.
Yes.
And it's okay to call out an issue and realize that there is another issue deeper with it and try to work on all of those aspects. Because we need to.
Yeah, it's incredibly important. And, you know, just being made aware of it is obviously the first step. Figuring out what we can do from here on out is the next one. The internet is a vast resource. I found a lot of sustainable plus size clothing that I know I'm going to start saving up for anytime I need new clothes so I can start making those changes myself. But just as a reminder, if you can't make those changes with your wallet, making other people aware of what's going on. There are other things that you can do while you get yourself in a place where you can financially make those changes in your clothing. It's not easy, but there are other things that you can do until you're in a financial place that you can make that change.
It always helps to be an advocate. It always helps to speak on these issues, even if we can't presently change it in our own lives.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of phenomenal journalists who are out there really trying to make this issue known. Share those. Share the Guardian article. Share some of these sources. It's quick, it's easy, it's free, and it's something that we can do to start change or, you know, help contribute to change now.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you, Katie.
Yeah.
As terrible as all that was, it is, we need to talk about it. And thank you so much for doing the work to bring that information.
I know it's a little out of my norm. I don't know how I'm going to make TikToks about this, but anyone who is still here listening, thank you
find a way.
So much for listening.
We very much appreciate you. Oh, I'll check from our intro recording, but we do have the Patreon. We know we're just going to keep mentioning it for a while. But I also wanted to, because I forgot to do this in our intro today, we got our first patron on Patreon.
Yes, we did.
And this person did not request anything specific, but she did get the first tier, so she gets a shout out. Our first patron was Selena, my sister-in-law, who has been an avid listener since the beginning. And we really appreciate her. And it's so exciting that she was our first patron. Like, it warmed my heart so much. We were on FaceTime when the notification came up on my phone, and I got so excited. So, Selena, we love you. Thank you for contributing to covering the costs of this.
Yes, thank you so much, Selena. You're amazing.
We appreciate it, and we love you so much, and I can't wait to see you in person.
Yay.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
For any photos related to today's episode, please go to our Instagram.
You can follow us on Instagram and TikTok at AL2KPodcast.
Like us on Facebook at Always the Last to Know Podcast.
If you have any questions, please email us at AL2KPodcast@gmail.com.
Please share, rate, and review us on your podcast listening app of choice.
Join our Patreon. You can find us at patreon.com/AL2KPodcast or click the link in our bio on social media.
Thank you for listening.